I'm John Weber, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. The 2018 fiscal year begins July 1st for most states, which means budgets must be set by midnight tonight. But for Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, meeting that deadline is not a done deal. In Pennsylvania, a $32 billion bipartisan budget spending package awaits approval, but lawmakers aren't sure how they'll find the cash to fund it. WHYY's Katie Meyer explains.
The legislature sent out a budget plan to Governor Wolf, but they did it without a revenue package. So it's a spending plan. This is essentially what we saw last year from the legislature and the governor, where they passed a spending commitment, but not the money to back it up. So that's going to be over the next week or so. We're going to see more negotiations from the legislature on that. It should be said that the governor only has 10 days to sign a bill once it's on his desk. And so that clock starts now. They are saying that they will have a revenue package within those 10 days. They're sort of committing to that. So we will see if they do follow through on it. The legislature is not supposed to be back in session until, I believe, July 6th looks like the day. But we do know that leaders and staff are probably going to be in talks over the weekend and over the holiday as well.
Turning to New Jersey, Governor Chris Christie won't let the state budget pass unless Democrats vote on a particular controversial bill. WHYY's Joe Hernandez has details.
The budget stalemate has come down to a fight between Republican Governor Chris Christie and Assembly Speaker Vinny Prieto. Christie wants a bill that would let the state take control of surplus money at Horizon, which is the state's largest health insurer. And Christie wants to use that money to fund his anti-opioid efforts. But Prieto, the Assembly Speaker, opposes the bill. He's worried that premiums would rise for policyholders, so he's refusing to put it up for a vote in the Assembly. Now, the Horizon bill doesn't actually affect the budget, but Christie is demanding it as part of a deal to get the budget through. Christie did get another bill he was asking for, which uses proceeds from the state lottery to fund the pension system. Now, the deadline to pass a budget is midnight tonight, so if that doesn't happen, it could trigger the state's first government shutdown since 2006. Back then, courts shut their doors, the state lottery stopped, and parks and beaches closed for the July 4th weekend, so a shutdown could have a significant impact on residents.
Delaware is noted for its punctuality when it comes to its budget, but this year's negotiations may lead to a first for the first state. From WHYY's Delaware desk, Mark Eichmann gives this update.
We got a preview last night of what to expect tonight in Dover. Earlier in the week, the state's budget committee put together a spending plan, implemented pretty drastic cuts in education and also in funding for nonprofits in the state. Those cuts totaled about $88 million and balanced the state budget. Then around 11 o'clock last night, Thursday night, Democrats in the state House tried to restore some of those cuts in the grant and aid bill after a lot of outcry from members of the nonprofit community in Delaware. So they put forth a measure that raised revenue through increased personal income taxes. Republicans who have opposed any kind of income tax increase, unless they get more concessions on spending, accuse the Democrats of trying to break House rules to get all that done. So members of the GOP caucus left the House, and then that caused the vote to fail. So Democrats probably bring that back tonight. I'm not sure what will happen if Republicans will walk out again or if they will vote. Republicans have also drafted legislation that would continue to fund the state government beyond tonight's midnight deadline if there can't be an agreement on the budget by July 1st, midnight tonight. So typically lawmakers wrap up their session in the wee hours of July 1st, but there's been more and more talk this year than we've ever heard in years past that a deal won't get done and lawmakers are going to have to come back on another day to somehow find compromise. That would be a historic first for Delaware General Assembly and would be pretty much uncharted territory, so not sure when they would come back, whether Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So lots of moving pieces and no real way to tell how it will play out, but we'll be watching.
The holiday weekend will come and go without a Senate vote on a new health care bill. NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller sat down with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll, for a checkup regarding Americans' thoughts on health care.
Well, we know of the concern all Americans have about the future of health care access, but are Americans, by and large, fine with the Senate more or less punting on this version?
Probably they are, Dave, but it's very complex. In terms of the Republican version of the health care bill per se, there have been a couple of recent polls showing Americans are quite negative about it rather than positive. The NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll asked about it and found 55% disapproving in the way they phrased it was the health care plan Senate Republicans have proposed. Only 17% approve. There was another poll by Quinnipiac which showed virtually the same results, majority disapproval. So clearly there's no great affection for the bill that the Republicans have come up with. Although I have to say, a lot of this is impressionistic, of course. Most Americans have not sat down, or none of us maybe even had the ability to sit down and really go through it line by line. We do know, however, from previous research, Dave, that Americans would like tweaks in the Affordable Care Act. I think almost everybody says that. Even Obama agrees that it needs tweaks. So the idea that there would be changes made is fine with Americans. But as mentioned, these particular changes, as far as the average American understands them, right now get majority disapproval.
The GOP mantra, though, has been repeal and replace. If you're merely suggesting that tweaks would do the trick, I guess they're not in favor of repeal and replace.
That's right. Although that's complex, too. I've looked at our Gallup polling on that and a number of other polls, and it kind of depends on how many options you give people. You know, if you give them a number of options, repeal, keep it, but make serious changes, and so forth and so on, you get some different results. But my interpretation of the polling data, looking at it very carefully, is Americans are not necessarily demanding the R word, repeal per se. That doesn't really matter to Americans. Americans say to Congress, tweak the bill, change it, make it better, and let's get on with it.
Now, in effect, a limited version of the Trump administration's travel ban, with the Supreme Court taking up the full issue this fall. It's a good time to weigh in on what Americans think about this.
A little more split than is the case with the Republican health care bill we were just talking about, but tilts negative. When we last asked about it a couple of months ago, 47% of Americans disagreed with the ban, 40% agreed, and that left the rest saying they didn't have an opinion. So that's not a majority, but clearly a plurality who disagree with it. We know there's partisanship, polarization in most things we ask about, but this was just amazing to us because we had 76% of Republicans who agreed with the idea of the travel ban, and 77% within a point of Democrats who disagreed. So it's this huge, huge polarization and symmetry on both sides of this highly controversial issue.
Finally, Frank, on this Independence Day weekend, why don't we leave on a point of pride regarding how others see America as the land of hope and opportunity?
Yeah, one of our analysts just spent quite a bit of time looking at data collected from countries around the world. Very fascinating. You need to go to Gallup.com and really look at it, because we asked people everywhere around the world, over 140 countries, would you leave if you could? Boy, is there some evidence of bad times, like in sub-Saharan Africa and the Dominican Republic and places like that, where huge percents of the population said, yes, I would move if I could, which is fascinating in and of itself. But germane to what you were asking about, we followed up and said, all right, where would you go if you could move? And the point of pride for the U.S., despite all our problems in this country, Dave, the U.S. By far is the number one destination where people who want to outmigrate from their country would like to come. The next country in order is Germany, and then Canada, and then the United Kingdom, and then France, and then Australia. But the United States is head and shoulders above all those other countries.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
Seth Williams' corruption trial came to an abrupt end yesterday when the former Philly DA accepted a plea deal. For NewsWorks blogger Solomon Jones, Williams' misconduct comes as a betrayal to Philadelphia's black community.
Former Philadelphia District Attorney Seth Williams has pleaded guilty to bribery and resigned from office. Initially charged with 29 counts of bribery, extortion, and fraud in a federal indictment, Williams denied for months that he had exchanged legal favors for bribes. But Thursday, in a stunning development, Williams pleaded guilty to accepting a bribe from a wealthy businessman. As part of the plea deal, Williams admitted to the additional conduct described in the federal indictment against him. He was led away in handcuffs and faces up to 5 years in prison when U.S. District Judge Paul Diamond sentences him on October 24th. Given that Williams took money meant for his mother's nursing home care, solicited vacations, cash, and other goods from two wealthy businessmen, and used the powers of his office to do favors for his benefactors, I'm certain the guilty plea was warranted, but I'm still incredibly angry. I'm angry because even as Williams prosecuted five black public officials who accepted but did not report small gifts from a government informant, he'd collected $175,000 in unreported gifts from two wealthy businessmen. The hypocrisy he exhibited was galling, but he repeatedly told me in radio interviews that what he had done was not the same thing he prosecuted others for doing. Clearly, he was right. Seth Williams' actions were not the same as the actions of the public officials he prosecuted. Seth Williams' actions were worse. Not only did he sell official favors in exchange for a car, vacations, cash, and other trinkets, he stole money meant to pay for his mother's nursing home care, misused campaign funds, and drove city cars for personal use. And he did it all while assuring the black community that he was seeking justice on our behalf. I come on here all the time and tell you that it's important to hold people accountable for having violated our laws, Williams told me last year in a December 22nd radio interview. He was talking about Dante Rollins, a young man Williams helped to free after Rollins was falsely imprisoned for 10 years. In reality, though, Williams could have been talking about himself. He must be held accountable, not only for the crimes he has committed, but also for the dreams he has dashed. We hoped the city's first black district attorney would help to exonerate more young men like Dante Rollins. We believed he would understand what it means to be an African American in a criminal justice system where blacks face harsher sentences than whites charged with similar offenses. We hoped that through Williams, we would finally gain a measure of justice. We didn't, and that angers me, because now we are left with virtually nothing. Williams, by his own admission, is guilty of accepting bribes. As a man of faith, I will pray that he receives mercy. But as a black man, I'll pray that justice is done. I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog at newsworks.org. Following February's deadly hostage taking at Vaughan Correctional Center in Smyrna, Delaware, the Correction Officers Union is producing a documentary allowing guards to tell their story. From the Delaware desk, WHYY's Mark Eichmann reports.
The job that we do is one of the most, if not the most, dangerous job.
The documentary, Hidden in Plain Sight, is a rare look inside Delaware's prisons told by those who work there, people like Correctional Officer Angelina Dealey.
We knew it was coming. It was classic textbook. There were guys put in that building, free roaming with other inmates that should have never had contact with other people at all, period.
Life became very real for us that day because all the things that we thought could never happen, happened that day.
That day was February 1st when inmates took control of the C building at Vaughan Correctional, holding both guards and other inmates hostage. The siege, which resulted in the death of Correctional Officer Lieutenant Stephen Floyd, was finally resolved nearly 20 hours later. In the following weeks and months, lots of questions have been asked about conditions inside Delaware's prisons. The people most familiar with the answers to those questions, correctional officers, are rarely, if ever, allowed to talk about it with reporters. To get around that, the officers' union, led by union president Jeff Klopp, is working on a documentary to tell their side of the story.
The public doesn't know what a correction officer does. You guys just don't know. And we feel part of what we need, you know, and people say, oh, why do you need money? Why do you need this? Why do you need that? We need to show you guys what our job really is.
In addition to shining a light on that deadly February day, union leaders hope the documentary introduces the public to correctional officers in a more personal way.
We don't get the public interaction that a trooper or a nurse or a paramedic does, you know, because all of our work is done behind a fence. You know, those guys, you know, you get to interact with the public on occasion and people get a better understanding of their job. Ultimately, you know, it's our job to communicate to the public exactly what we're doing.
It also puts a human face on the difficulties correctional officers face. Terry Jelliff is a retired correctional officer.
Until you get the jails properly manned, inmates aren't going to get what they need. Officers don't have the safety and the security to provide what they need.
Only give us $32,000 a year. for this type of work is a slap in the face. It's disappointing because we're dealing with criminals on every level.
To ease Officer Nicole Downing's concerns about pay, earlier this month, the state announced a plan to increase starting pay for officers by 22% over 2 years. It would go from $33,000 to $43,000 by fiscal year 2019. Union President Jeff Klopp calls it a good first step.
We can't get people to apply for the job with the salary the way it is, and some institutions, 60% of our daily operational needs are overtime. And that's not going to change for a couple months, you know, as we start the process moving forward.
Union leaders aren't sure when the documentary will be finished and released, but they're hoping it will be an informative and effective tool to help improve conditions behind bars.
And our goal is to show you just how difficult our job is of managing the people that are incarcerated that nobody wants to really deal with. It's going to be good for everybody.
From the Delaware desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
A horse riding club in a blighted section of North Philadelphia is the subject of a large art installation at the Barnes Foundation. A French artist lived with the Fletcher Street Urban Riding Club for 8 months in 2014. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports the artist collaborated with the riders to make the work.
The Fletcher Street Urban Riding Club is no stranger to media attention. Mostly they get visits from photographers and filmmakers who are attracted to the juxtaposition of urban black teenagers and horses galloping through the streets of North Philadelphia. But when artist Mohamed Bourissa came not to make a movie about them, but to make a movie with them, he says the riders were thrown for a loop.
What you want to do is strange. We don't understand what you want to do, because it was common for them to have the people come and take a picture and leave, you know? Looking like the guys come and he want to make a project, he want to leave in this place. It's so strange. Like, why do you want to do that?
As you can hear, Bourissa is French. His choppy English made him a misfit in North Philadelphia. He's also Algerian, which makes him a misfit in his native France. He says that outsider status helped him bond with the riders of Fletcher Street, whose love of horses have made them misfits in their own African-American neighborhood. Bourissa spent 8 months with the Horse Club, at one point staging a horse pageantry event with elaborate garlands made by local artists. He returned to his studio in Paris to make the work, and it's now on display at the Barnes Foundation. It includes dozens of sketches hung on a wooden structure resembling a horse stable, a 15-minute documentary, and wall assemblages made of car parts and sheet metal printed with images of the urban riders. Bourissa says it's as much about himself as it is about the riders.
I feel some similarity between to be an African-American here in the United States and to be an Algerian from the suburb in France. I think there is like a similar thing. For sure, it's totally different. I don't want to say it's the same, but you have some similarity.
Bourissa says his work is informed by a political championing of a post-colonial underclass. The installation will be on view until October. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm John Weber for Newsworks Tonight.